You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 19th of April 2024 on Monocle Radio.
The United States prepares to uncork its bottled-up aid to Ukraine. Ukraine reminds the United States that once liberated, it will need to be rebuilt, and the two lucky Italian cities hosting Monocle expeditions. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. It's Friday, so it's our weekly in-house daily, and the Monocle staffers who couldn't get out of it, whether or not they went to an arts festival in Venice or a furniture fair in Milan, are Chris Chermak, Julia Lassiter, Nick Manise, Ed Stocker, Grace Charlton and Rob Bound. They will discuss the day's big stories and or arts festivals in Venice and furniture fairs in Milan, and we'll hear about the latest efforts to secure funds not only for Ukraine's defence today, but its reconstruction tomorrow. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined, first of all, by Monocle's senior news editor, Chris Chermak, and by Monocle writer and researcher, Julia Lassiter. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hello.
I mean, normally at this point in the show, Chris, we chat to the guests a bit about where they have been lately, but I don't need to ask you because I know because I was there as well.
We have been getting to know each other very well, haven't we, Andrew?
That sounded vaguely sinister. yes, we did. We went last week to the Delphi Economic Forum. The fruits of our labours, I can exclusively reveal, will turn up in tomorrow's edition of the Foreign Desk.
They were, and it's, may I say, I'm happy to be part of the Foreign Desk team. It will be my first episode as producer of the Foreign Desk, so we're looking forward to the Delphi Economic Forum special.
Shall we tell people a little bit about what's in it? What highlight leapt out of this episode of the many for you?
I mean, many, obviously, but we have a president, so that is always a highlight,
an
actual president, Slovenia's president. But we also, perhaps particularly given my own background, having lived in Germany for a number of years, I found the German ambassador to Greece particularly interesting, Andreas Kindl, defending Germany's position and role in Greece, shall we say, somewhat controversial role over the last 10 to 15 years or so.
Well, indeed, I do recommend that interview in particular to our listeners as a masterclass in how to rebuild a diplomatic relationship. As you intimate, Chris, it had got rather rickety between Germany and Greece. Julia, you, by way of contrast, have been to Amsterdam.
Yeah, just for fun, not for any forums or conferences or anything like that.
You could have made one up.
We would never have known.
But have you been there many times before? We were saying just before we came on air that it is a thoroughly charming city. Once you get out of the bits of it that aren't thoroughly charming, the bits of it that are thoroughly charming are thoroughly charming.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. I was actually really surprised. I've been there a few times when I was younger, but never really like with my friends just to have, you know, fun, whatever. And I was just so surprised by, well, first of all the tulips, beautiful. Like, I mean, it's just gorgeous. Everywhere you look, there are just all these gorgeous flowers and on the windowsills.
It's almost like this were a thing for them or something.
Yeah, it's almost as if.
I genuinely do love a city that leans into the cliches, though. That place where you go, there you go, yeah, of course, this
also,
is what they have here.
They're just really nice flowers. They're so beautiful. The colours, everything. It's just beautiful.
They are. I do have some in my garden, but due to this useless spring that we are having here in London, we can complain about this. There's not any British people on the show.
That's true. And we were just in Greece, which has fabulous weather in Delphi, which blue skies every day.
Which has proper weather. But we will move along to the United States via Ukraine or vice versa. And this weekend, the U.S. House of Representatives will vote and hopefully slash probably aye on a long delayed foreign aid bill, which includes $60 billion worth of assistance to Ukraine. The Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, has signaled that he will at last bring the bill to a vote, even if one consequence may be the yanking from his hand of the Speaker's gavel by the very same Republican Yahoo caucus which awarded it to him, one of whom, Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, has sought to scupper the bill by barnacling it with nuisance amendments, including a requirement that any member voting in favour must join the Ukrainian military. Julia, as regular listeners will be aware, you are entitled to have less of a sense of humour than most about Marjorie Taylor Greene's interventions and indeed about the hold-up to this aid package. Is it possible to quantify what difference it has made to the people trying to defend Ukraine?
Yeah, I mean, funerals all the time. There was a funeral today, actually, of a prominent Ukrainian civic activist who was responsible for, you know, changing Ukraine for the better. He was one of the actors and he was on the front line and he was killed. And I'm certain that him and families who've been killed, sleeping in their homes, soldiers on the front lines, fathers, mothers, wives, all these people would, you know, have had a much higher chance of surviving if it weren't for people like Marjorie Taylor Greene towing the Kremlin line in the halls of power in the US.
Starkly put there by Julia, Chris, that the consequence of this holdup has been funerals, and many of them for Ukrainians. Is it basically possible to explain to bewildered listeners what the holdup has been? As we have remarked many times before, you don't need to be that old to recall a time at which the Republican Party of the United States, of all institutions, would have been right behind an Eastern European country seeking to liberate itself from Moscow's clutches.
Of course, and I think it's important to say that all of this has essentially been about politics, and it's been about the politics of the fringe in the United States. We had a vote today in the House of Representatives, a procedural motion in order to get this bill to the floor of the House tomorrow. And, you know, when you say the Republican Party, whether the Republican Party itself has shifted, it's important to say that this vote was about 300, more than 300 of members of the House voted in favor of the bill, and also 151 Republicans voted in favor of the bill. Only 50 Republicans voted against it. And I think this just goes to show how much all of this over the last 6 months, 1 year, has been about a fringe that has been able to hold up something that even Republicans agree with in the United States, at least a majority of them do. But because Donald Trump has spoken about this, he has tried to hold it up to some degree. People like Marjorie Taylor Greene, as you mentioned as well, they have been playing politics with this issue, also simply, you know, representing an extreme isolationist wing of the U.S. That has basically said, we need to stop doing this. There is no point. We need to fix our borders first. And what's been extraordinary for me over the last 6 to 9 months or so is just the amount of power they have had on that, given that the majority still supports aid to Ukraine. I always imagined that this bill would get through. And when I was in the U.S. reporting from there, where it was kind of telling people that to say, oh, well, this is still a fringe. They are going to get over that hurdle. What's been incredible is that Speaker Mike Johnson has catered to that hurdle because his own position as Speaker has been so perilous. Any one of the few of these Republicans who oppose the bill could unseat him. And that's really been what's been key here. He needs to keep his Republican conference together. He finally decided, well, I can't keep my Republican conference together. I'm going to rely on Democrats because of the narrow majority I have. He did that in quite extraordinary circumstances, using measures that have actually never been done in the House before, with a sort of committee vote where actually Democrats had to back Republicans in order to get it through. So he has taken some pretty extraordinary steps to finally push this maybe to the line tomorrow.
Julia, I'll ask you a similar question to the one I already did, but from the opposite and perhaps more optimistic view, which is the difference that will be made to Ukraine's struggle by the release of these funds. Obviously, the mood over Ukraine has grown somewhat more pessimistic over the last few months, especially as these funds have been held up. But as far as it's possible to tell, does Ukraine's military, Ukraine's government, do they perceive or foresee quite swift results to this funding being released?
I'm not sure, to be honest, first of all, the effect will be immediate. Ukraine will feel once again that they have, they have the support that they need to keep going, because words can only last you for so long and then you're sort of lacking with oxygen. One of the important things that the bill has in its wording is that it wants Ukraine to win, which is a really big change, because for months and months now, for a year even, people have been talking about, you know, that standing with Ukraine is not enough. It needs to be winning for Ukraine. And the fact that that wording is there will change a shift, will show a change in the dynamic of the support. And European allies have kind of been feeling that dynamic and they've been stepping up their support. But the fact that that wording is there, and there are going to be several really important things in the bill as well about using Russian assets, frozen Russian assets, to pay for reconstruction and for funding. There will be ATACMS in the bill, which is a really important thing that Ukrainians have been waiting for a long time. So I think that there will be a change in the mood. I think there are a lot of misgivings. I think America has really showed its capriciousness, and Ukrainians will be very wary going forward. But I think that if this gets through, and if, because of course we need to wait for it to get through before we say anything, then I think there will be a change in the mood and things will hopefully start to pick up again.
Just finally and briefly on this, Chris, if this goes through, as we do expect it to, does that largely neutralise, do you think, Ukraine as an election issue in this presidential election?
Yeah, that's a good point, Andrew. I think it does to some degree neutralize Ukraine. There will be those voices who will try and make this an election issue and say that, you know, Ukraine funding has gone through while we have not secured the border in the United States, which is the line of the fringe. But I don't think it's going to have a huge impact, to be honest. We've even seen that in this debate, because Mike Johnson, for example, the speaker himself, is likely to hold on to his job, because you've seen the sort of Christian right rally to his defense despite backing this Ukraine bill. So in that sense, too, I think we've seen the support for Ukraine kind of, now that it's over the hurdle, I don't think it'll be a huge U.S. election issue. Even Donald Trump himself, frankly, has said that, you know, Ukraine should be loaned the money. And it's actually important to say that is technically this is going to be a loan, although the debt can be canceled at a future step. So they have catered even to Donald Trump with this bill, which suggests even he is relatively happy with what is happening tomorrow. And therefore, I think it takes Ukraine to at least some larger degree off the table for the elections.
Chris Chermak and Julia Lassica, thank you both for joining us. Sticking with the subject at hand, top Ukrainian officials have been in Washington, D.C. this week, attending the spring meetings of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, and also making the case for international support for the eventual reconstruction of their country. As our Washington-based reporter Simon Marks has been finding out, if it's hard getting some figures in the US Capitol to back military assistance for Ukraine, it may be even harder to secure their support for Ukraine's reconstruction.
You are listening to a musical rendition of what Ukraine might one day look like. Back on its feet, freed from the gloom of Russia's deadly and relentless war. It is a piece of jazz called the Ukrainian Renaissance Suite, and it was recorded last autumn in Berlin by a group of musicians led by Jean-Pierre Frehley. He is more than a guitar player. He is also the top German diplomat planning the Ukraine Reconstruction Conference that will take place in Berlin in June.
Recovery is not a top-down exercise just by donors or state, but it's a multi-stakeholder approach where you have to engage lots of different players.
Mr. Frehley has spent the past week shuttling between various delegations at the World Bank and the IMF spring meetings here in Washington, preparing them for the day after in Ukraine. It's estimated that up to $1 trillion will be needed to put the country back on its feet, and he argues that process will begin in a few weeks' time in the German capital.
We will have civil society, business representatives, NGOs, gathering with political head of states and governments, and also regional representatives, because we see that international partnerships on all levels are key here.
Given the scale of the ongoing conflict, there has been considerable talk here this week about the state of the Ukrainian economy and the country's ongoing requests for military assistance. $60 billion of fresh aid from the US remains stuck in Congress amid opposition from Trump-backed Republicans. But on the economic front, the IMF offered Kyiv a relatively positive review. Julie Kozak is the fund's director of communications.
The Ukrainian economy continues to show remarkable resilience. Risks related to the ongoing war and delays in external financing remain exceptionally high. Timely and predictable external financing is critical for sustaining the hard-earned economic gains.
Among Ukrainian officials in Washington this week to hear that message, the country's Prime Minister, Denis Shmyhal. He has split his time here, on the one hand focusing on additional military assistance that the White House says will be critical in determining the outcome of the war, but on the other hand accentuating the need to prepare for his country's eventual reconstruction.
The main resource for Ukraine's recovery should be Russian state assets frozen in Western countries. This is about $300 billion. We will not just win the war, but we should win the peace. By rebuilding our country, it's clear for all of us.
He knows it will not be easy forcing Russia to pay the costs for the destruction it has wrought on Ukraine. There will be enormous legal hurdles for Western countries to overcome, even if they try to use Moscow's frozen assets to foot the bill. But the Prime Minister, who met with leaders of US private sector firms, was emphasizing the opportunities that he says will one day exist to assist in Ukraine's recovery and make money out of it at the same time.
Support of United States is not charity. This is absolutely pragmatic idea to support Ukraine and support United States producers. This is like both beneficial story for supporting to each other.
That argument is designed to counter the critique of Ukraine's detractors in the United States, many of whom are on the right of Donald Trump's Republican Party. They are not only implacably opposed to sending more military assistance to Kyiv, they also don't care much for the idea of nation building once the war is over.
The U.S. is focusing on it so much past our national interest.
Dr. Shay Bradley Farrell heads the Counterpoint Institute, a non-profit organization that seeks to amplify conservative voices in America's foreign policy debate. She argues the U.S. has done more than enough to help Ukraine at the cost of paying attention to what she argues are more urgent problems at home, including the immigration crisis on America's southern border.
We have given the largest foreign assistance package, Simon, since the end of World War II and the Marshall Plan already to Ukraine. We have to also have some sort of balance on this because we have a real obsession right now with pouring money into Ukraine. We have serious problems at home that I want our Congress and our administration to focus on.
Not all Republicans agree, and at the think tank operated by former President George W. Bush in Dallas, Texas, you can find a different viewpoint.
It is really not assistance for Ukraine. It's for the United States' own industrial and defense base, which frankly have degraded.
Igor Krestin is the Bradford M. Freeman Director of Global Policy at the George W. Bush Institute.
This reconstruction is not going to be a burden. There's quite a bit of opportunity in Ukraine for America's private sector companies and others around the world to partake in the reconstruction projects. Ukraine has its own agency, Ukrinvest, that is geared towards attracting private sector investment and making sure that this is not a burden on anyone's taxpayers.
Achieving that will be a gargantuan task, especially at a time when European governments are more nervous than American officials about the possibility of expropriating Russian assets to kickstart the rebuilding process. But while those conversations continue, in the world of the arts, the diplomat responsible for the Berlin Reconstruction Conference is already strumming a tune that he hopes will inspire the rest of the world to do their bit to rebuild Ukraine. For Monocle Radio, I'm Simon Marks in Washington.
Thank you, Simon. You're listening to the Monocle Daily. This is The Daily on Monocle Radio, and now to Salone del Mobile, where our Monocle team of intrepid furniture reporters is ready to review what they learned about this week's design fair. Monocle's design editor, Nick Manise, take it away.
Thank you very much, Andrew Muller. Well, as you said, we are here in Milan. The Monocle team is assembled around the Monocle radio desk at the House of Switzerland for our last broadcast from Milan. It's been a roller coaster of a week. Ed Stocker, Grace Charlton, how are the energy levels?
Pretty good.
Yeah. Wavering
that,
a little bit.
That did not sound convincing at all. I mean,
we sound energized.
I have been energized though by
You're
some amazing,
energized,
amazing
Nick,
conversations. We've had the chance to speak to so many amazing people over the last few days. I think about what is going on in Milan, but also not what's going on in Milan. I guess also their design practice. I want to hear about some of your highlights. Can I ask you to talk about Charles O'Job, Grace? I mean, he's one of a top designer. I was a little bit jealous you got to do this interview.
He's so lovely, like honestly the nicest soul. It sounds really cheesy, but he is. He was just around to get some inspiration, see what kind of projects were on. He excitingly is in the Triennale, one of his pieces that he submitted to Salone Satellite, I think over 20 years ago, is now in the Triennale. So he went and saw it there and looked at the other people's work, and he was just really chuffed to be back in Milan. And
I love that as like a throw to like, okay, yes, Milan Design Week's over, but the Triennale is always open, and you can see the Satellite exhibition there, I think, for a little while after. I mean, tell us about Satellite itself this year. Or maybe for our people listening at home, and definitely Andrew Muller, who is listening in from London, who doesn't know what Salone Satellite is. What is it?
It's the section of the fair at the Rho Fiera, so in the halls of Salone del Mobile, dedicated to designers who are under the age of 35, and always a highlight for me. I love seeing what people from all around the world are up to.
But I mean, like, were there any particular forms, any like countries you think that were quite well represented at Satellite?
A lot of Japanese and Korean designers who I just love what they do. I'm obsessed with their like approach to simplicity and sort of pared back shapes, and yeah, a lot of aluminium on show as well. There was a collaboration between all these Mexican designers, and they'd come to Salone with all their like aluminium chess sets.
Speaking of metal, metal heads, Ed, you just spoke to a designer who's in a death metal band. I mean, this is the beauty of the week. You do get to have these in-depth discussions with people that you wouldn't have expected and learn things about them.
Yeah, that was Domenico Diego Votto Studio. He said that, you know, when he's not, you know, product designing, he's playing in a death metal band.
Can you see yourself joining him for a little bit of a jam sesh? Or
maybe not, but who knows? Maybe I'll, you know, go and see one of his concerts. You know, I live in Milan, so maybe I'll check out his next gig in the town.
And this is funny. So this is your hometown of sorts.
Well, I mean, what are you suggesting?
I do feel like a true Milanese now. Are you in with the set?
Well, I have lived here for 4 years, so I think that's enough.
That's chunky,
sort of, you know. Call myself a.
So, but how do you see the city change over the course of this week? Do you like it? Are you annoyed by the crowds? Is it a good excuse to get out of the house?
I mean, it is a good excuse to get out of the house, Nick. Thanks for that. I definitely noticed it, how busy it was this year, which is amazing. But the city changes a lot. You know, I think it's quite a well-known fact about Milan that it is quite a private city, as in there's a lot behind doors. You know, there's a lot of amazing inner courtyard stuff you don't necessarily see unless you have the access. And I think just one of the amazing things about this week are the activations, the fact that we see brands activating spaces, throwing open doors to amazing historic palazzi or cloisters or just these little spaces you didn't know exist. And you go inside and you're like, wow, look at the roof of this building, and there's this amazing internal grassed area with statues. And, you know, I may have been down that street before, but I've never been in there. And I swear, just some of the streets that I go to a lot, suddenly I'm like, wow, this looks... Have you done something? Has Milan done something? Because I'm like, this street looks even more beautiful than ever. But I think it's also the time of year. Such a great time to have, you know, an event. You know, it really is the beginning of spring with everything flourishing. So the city's at its finest, I'd say.
I mean, because it is quite fascinating. People do host, like designers even host events in their own home. And I just spoke to Objects of Buyer who are showing in their own apartment. are you welcoming people through the doors during the weekend? Are we able to come into your house? Or would you, maybe the question is, would you ever throw an exhibition in your own home?
I just don't think my home is enough, as high design.
It's nice. It's
high
nice.
Design
this
enough.
Is me looking for a dinner invite tonight, by the way.
You've already invited yourself over once, and once was probably enough, Nick Manise. I'm joking.
That's quite hurtful. Grace Charlton, would you ever throw the doors open of your home if you were running a design brand to showcase your wares? No.
I think, no way. I don't trust people to not, like, break something.
Yeah, I know.
But it is an interesting part of Milan that does happen a lot, that people do that.
I don't know
if that happens in many other design fairs.
I spend a lot of time bouncing around between fairs, and I think this is the only place where I've actually been invited into people's homes. And it's not even like it's a thing this year. It's been ongoing for a number of years. I mean, and perhaps it does make sense. You know, if you're going to host a dinner party, having people sit on these new chairs you've designed, why not do it in your own space? I mean, incredible venues. Where else have you been this year, Grace, that really jumped out at you as an amazing space to be in, not just the work but also the actual architecture?
Well, I really liked Capsule Plaza at Spazio Maiocchi. I mean, the sort of Milanese palazzi are gorgeous, but I do like the sort of industrial heritage in the city, and that space is, like, you know, poured concrete and glass and steel, and it was a nice switch. Oh, my life is so hard, from, like, cocktails and a palazzo.
And it's away from the madness of it, isn't it, in Porta Venezia?
Yeah. I think that is. It's having that moment to get away. I mean, closing remarks from both of you. What do you take away from the week? Is it a little bit of inspiration? Is it maybe a few new watering holes or restaurants that you also come across? Do you have any tips for our listeners or for Andrew Muller back in the studio that might entice him to come out here next year?
Well, that's a tough one, but I do like it when studios or companies stage or take over a bar. Marimekko did it. They've staged Bar Unico this year, and it's really cute. There's Nuova Group. They've taken over a bistro, and I'm going to add it to my list on Google Maps.
Love that. Ed Stocker?
Well, sadly, some of those things might stick around. I guess the bars and the restaurants will, but the installations, no. I mean, obviously, because I'm based here, it's just, you know, it's really nice to, I've met some people who are based here that I didn't know before. Hopefully, we can continue those conversations.
You've made new friends, Ed Stocker.
I just love me. I just want someone to love me.
That's all we really want. And hold me? I don't know. Anyway, that's probably an appropriate time to cut this off. We're going to throw back to our friend, Andrew Muller, in the studio in London.
Nick Manise, Grace Charlton and Ed Stocker, thank you. You are listening to The Monocle Daily. We will move somewhat north now to Venice, where another Monocle team has been spending the week at the Venice Biennale. Earlier, I spoke with Monocle's senior correspondent Rob Bound about what he had learned and about a particularly curious picture. Rob, first of all, I am given to understand and indeed have seen the photographic evidence that you have been banging a gong wielded by somebody in a pink gown while wearing a silly hat. Please explain.
Wouldn't it be a terrible bet you'd taken on, Andrew, if that wasn't the case? yes, so I was invited to the opening or the sort of groundbreaking ceremony of a new art institution on San Giacomo Island, just off Venice. This lunchtime, and there was a kind of a mad pink themed Korean sort of opening ceremony, which involved all the things you'd love, bright pink outfits, drones, and a lot of crazy makeup. So I'm sorry to have to stand in for you in this instance, Andrew, but it was me banging the drum. And this did have a sort of vaguely serious artistic intent behind it. The big Italian art collector from Turin, Patrizia Sandretto Rivadengo, who's got a big foundation, is a big art collector, is going to be building a new foundation on the island in a couple of years' time. But this was her way of keeping in the spotlight and having a groundbreaking ceremony. So it was a lot of fun. There was a nice lunch. And it was a little bit, I feel we might get on to slightly heavier topic. So this was the kind of pink storm that blew over a rather serious Biennale for the most part, I have to say.
Well, indeed so, because the Biennale does, as art likes to, reflects the state of the world. And how much of the currently somewhat wretched state of the world are you seeing at this year's Biennale?
Well, I mean, obviously you've been reporting this month in, month out, Andrew, on the Daily and on Monocle News shows. And the Biennale is is comments upon and is not immune to the news. There's been protests here, the state of the Israel pavilion, the Russian pavilion, and Ukrainian artists and what they've been proposing for the Biennale as well has been super interesting. So, in fact, yesterday, during one of the big sort of unveiling ceremonies near the British pavilion is the German pavilion, and there was a big pro-Palestine or anti-armament protest outside the German. It's a very specific anti-German protest, and the Israel pavilion simply has, which is a very beautiful 1950s modernist villa here in the Giardini in Venice, just has a very simple black and white sign in the window, like a sort of vacant poster that just says the artists and curators of the Israel Pavilion will not be showing any artwork until there is a ceasefire and sensible negotiations on hostage releases. So that's a sort of very bold statement of how the people behind the Israel Pavilion see the facts of the matter in the conflict in the Middle East. The Russian Pavilion, the Russians weren't invited to partake in this year's Biennale, so they have given it up to Bolivia. And as I said, there's a lot of Ukrainian artists providing all sorts of different things, all sorts of different viewpoints, all coming to the same conclusion, I think. And the Ukrainian pavilion is a sort of small, beautifully realized thing in the Arsenale, which is the sort of second string to the Giardini. And we got walked around that yesterday. And it's a very profound and moving and quite a joyful and hopeful pavilion, actually, trying to salvage some hope from the wreckage there, the Ukrainian pavilion.
Well, leaving aside the woes of the world, serious though they are any other themes managing to make themselves manifest?
Yeah, I mean, of course, there are, as we sort of started talking about at the top of the show, there's a lot of colour, a lot of zest and vibe and humour, and there's also a lot of serious messages being done with a glint in their eye and a sort of slightly arched eyebrow, Andrew, I have to say. In terms of sort of standard things, the Ethiopian pavilion was phenomenal. This was an artist, a figurative painter called Tefe Ergesa. It was a show that was curated by the British, he's of Ethiopian descent, but the British poet and writer Lenis Kitte. So those guys collaborated and to come up with topics and themes. And it's about migration, and it's about being a black person in a predominantly white country. But his paintings were beautiful, witty, kind of huge expressionist works of art, which were at the Palazzo Rivoli yesterday. So we walked around that. And a kind of whimsical and rather beautiful pavilion, the South Korean pavilion, the artist Koo Jong-ae made a wonderful show, which is a completely olfactory. Apart from some beautiful cedar infinity symbols carved into the floor of the Korean pavilion, the thing is entirely a work of scent. She asked Koreans to send in their scent memories, 600 scent memories of the peninsula of Korea. So it was North and South collaborating on that. So that was kind of lovely, memorable, quiet moment amongst the hard news and pink bonkersness of the Biennale.
And I just wanted to ask a more general question about Venice during the Biennale. As we have discussed on our shows more than once, Venice has had serious conversations with itself about whether or not it should start regulating even more strictly the influx of tourists. Venice is, of course, absolutely rammed even on the quietest of weekends. I'm guessing Biennale is not the quietest of times for Venice. How navigable is it?
Yeah, I mean, the Biennale itself is it's a strange thing to see the well-dressed and well-heeled squabbling over slices of pizza is always a dignified sight, Andrew. but it's the Giardini and the Arsenale are pretty well regulated. There's gates in and out. There's been a lot of more security than I've seen the last couple of times I've seen at the Biennale. I mean, as I say, there are people bringing their protest materials in and out. I don't know how easy that is to do, but obviously that one of these protests bore fruit yesterday. But the city is mad. I have to say, it's a brisk spring here in Venice, so the tourism at least are wearing sleeves and trousers. That sometimes has to be seen to be believed, so that's a good thing. In terms of the art displays, that's sort of super well policed and controlled. But fortunately, the rest of the town is a free-for-all. But yeah, looking back, coming back from San Giacomo Island into town this afternoon from that groundbreaking ceremony. You are suddenly, you get off the boat and you are in a swarm. And it, yeah, exactly. You need to know where you're looking and know where you're going and look purposeful.
or you could end up getting extremely damp. Rob Bound in Venice, thank you for joining us. And finally, on today's Daily, and sticking with the art world, in Venice this week, the imposing neoclassical pavilion of Great Britain has been taken over by the artist Sir John Acomfra. Entitled Listening All Night to the Rain, his commission engages with themes of memory, racial injustice and climate change. The sound and video-based works with which he's filled the space encourage visitors to consider the act of listening in new ways. And here he tells Monocle's Robert Bound about the journey visitors go on as they experience the pavilion through his works.
One of the things that always sort of seemed slightly anticlimactic about the pavilion is that you came in from the top. There was this grand staircase. You walked up. I mean, I've been coming here for 25 years, so I've experienced it a lot. And you come in and there's this huge hall and you kind of realize that about usually a third of it, maybe more, is taken up with texts. And then the rest is given over to a piece of work. And then after that, it sort of seems to me to go slightly downhill because the rest of the spaces are quite small, you know. So it always felt like a slightly weird, anticlimactic thing. And I was concerned about how one could reverse that logic so that the denouement to the show was the larger spaces, or at least the kind of crescendo was in the larger space, and then you tapered off slightly. And that suggested to me that one of the things you did was to close the front and have people come through the basement into it. So you have a piece in the basement, and then you come up from the basement. Now, you know, as you know, with anything to do with English public or private life, basements are important. And this is no exception. So I wanted to doff my cap to that.
There's all sorts of ways of taking that, the below stairs kind of vibe, and where the bodies are buried, and all sorts of things that you are riffing.
Absolutely, absolutely. So you come in and you are immersed in liquidity in water, but you're immersed in liquidity and water with objects and photographs and sonic artifacts and paintings and all trying to allude to this sense that water might have a memorial function, might have a way of retaining memory, which was actually a debate once in the 80s, a scientific debate about whether or not water can possess and retain memory. It was suggested by someone who was then rubbished by the scientific community, Jacques Benveniste in 88, but I love it as a kind of poetic concept. It might not be true scientifically, but it feels right to me poetically.
And there's a lot of, and water is all about, in that, it sounds like harking back to that original Chinese text, John, the idea of moving, you know, it's how we moved around the world before aeroplanes. We're in Venice, a none more wet town, I suppose, as well. And also a place of migration, of trade, of all the, you know, these palaces and churches and amazing squares were built on that sort of stuff. This work seems perfect for here in terms of kind of speaking to the shouting out from the Giardini to the rest of the town. It's definitely in conversation with it. I'd love to know a bit about the making a work specifically for this building, for this artistic engagement at the Biennale here in 2024, actually.
Well, I mean, any conversation with Venice is completely unintended. I have to say that because I feel like I'm being fake if I say, oh, we were doing this in conversation with Venice. Hell no. We were doing this in conversation with Brit culture, for sure, but definitely not Venice. I mean, I, you know, halfway through, I was like, oh, okay, man, Venice, water, oh, okay. But it wasn't where it started. You know, I was looking for a vessel that might function as a kind of motif for how memory works, the fluidity of it, the randomness of it, the seeming serenity of it, you know, all of those seem to me to be ways in which one can suggest the presence of memory. But I was doing that because we were, after we were tracking the ghost of listening. I wanted to do something about listening in a visual form. And it seemed to me that listening, at the very least, harked to something called memory. Because to listen is to be transported elsewhere. You know, when you listen, you're immediately, whatever it is, rain or music, or you're immediately placed elsewhere. So how to visualize the elsewhere then became the task, basically. And water was important for that.
That was Sir John Okomfara speaking to Rob Bound, and that is all for this edition of The Daily. And thanks to our panellists today, Chris Chermak, Julia Lassica, Nick Manise, Ed Stocker, Grace Charlton, and Rob Bound. Today's show was produced by Chris Chermak and researched by George Ruskin. Our sound engineer was Sarah Nicol, with editing assistance from David Stevens. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time on Monday. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.